The court, my name is Joshua Goff. I'm honored to be here today on behalf of Dano Armstrong Jr. And the question presented before the court was whether the trial court erred in refusing to grant Mr. Armstrong's motion to vacate his conviction due to the fact he was not allowed to testify. And the threshold question the court must decide, as presented in the Commonwealth's argument, is whether Mr. Armstrong did in fact testify at trial. And the fact of the matter is Mr. Armstrong certainly did not testify at trial. This was a case, a drug possession case, where a motion to suppress was filed pursuant to 19.2-266.2. And Mr. Armstrong testified for the limited purpose of whether the trial court or whether the police had probable cause to search his vehicle. Virginia Rule of Evidence 2:104 allows parties pursuant to constitutional standards and United States case Simmons versus United States to testify for the limited purpose of a motion to suppress or other pretrial motion. That's what Mr. Armstrong did in this particular case. And certainly the trial court itself pointed out at one location, page 41 of the appendix, that there's a different standard for a motion to suppress than at trial. The trial court had to evaluate Mr. Armstrong's testimony as well as the other witnesses who testified at the motion to suppress under a preponderance of the evidence standard. And certainly different rules of evidence apply to motions to suppress than at trial. For instance, if Mr. Armstrong had gotten into whether the marijuana was for personal use at the motion to suppress, there would have been an objection to relevance for that. That was in no way relevant to the motion to suppress, and he would not have been allowed to testify as to that. So the Commonwealth is incorrect in stating that because the testimony of the motion to suppress was incorporated into the trial for efficiency purposes to allow the Commonwealth to avoid having to point out Mr. Armstrong for identification purposes or to reiterate that this happened in the city of Newport News and not somewhere else, or on the offense date in question. All of those threshold matters were covered in the motion to suppress. And for efficiency purposes, the trial court and Mr. Armstrong's trial counsel just said, well, we can incorporate all that and get to the heart of the issue. But that testimony by Mr. Armstrong for a limited purpose was not trial testimony.
But how do you address the fact that what you said is fine until defense counsel affirmatively agreed that that would be evidence in this trial? Doesn't that wipe out all these limitations that you're saying?
No, Your Honor, it does not.
Why not?
Because, well, defense counsel remains silent, and I agree that's a waiver. The trial
did he not later say we have no other evidence to enter?
He did, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's what we're assigning
so
evidence.
So it was entered. Why doesn't that do the exact same thing as if he had then later gotten on the stand and repeated or changed whatever he had said?
Because Mr. Armstrong had a right to tell his side of the story at trial. That's not an unlimited right. He didn't have a right to get up there and say anything he wanted to, as the Commonwealth pointed out. But he had a right to provide a defense to the charge that was separate to whether law enforcement had probable cause to search his vehicle.
But with what counsel did not he submit that as his offering of his version, his words, into this trial?
And that was error for the trial court not to determine whether Mr. Armstrong wanted to testify about the underlying charge, about his version of events, not for the purposes of the motion to suppress, which is a different evidentiary standard and a different set of issues, but whether Mr. Armstrong had something to say at trial. And we properly preserved that issue when Mr. Armstrong filed a motion to vacate the conviction and put the trial court on notice that Mr. Armstrong wished to offer further evidence at trial as to why marijuana might possibly have been found in the vehicle. And the trial court erred in concluding that because it preemptively decided it wouldn't believe what Mr. Armstrong said because of what he said at the motion to suppress, he didn't have a right to testify at the trial. That's not the standard that either trial counsel has to follow or the trial court itself has to follow. Trial counsel certainly can't allow someone to knowingly commit perjury, but it's unclear as to exactly what trial counsel's duties are in this situation. I think most courts say that a criminal defendant is allowed, at the very least, to get up and make some sort of statement, because presumably there would be a situation where a defendant could tell each and every attorney he had that he's going to testify knowingly untruthfully to something, that person would have to be brought to trial eventually. So Mr. Armstrong, whether or not what his testimony was going to be contradicted what he said at the motion to suppress, which is not necessarily true. There are reasonable explanations as to his testimony at the motion to suppress and what his testimony would have been at trial. But the issue is whether he had the right to testify at trial at all. And Mr. Armstrong did have a right to get up and say his side of the story. Rock versus Arkansas, I submit, controls this case, and it says that criminal defendants, due to a number of different sections of the United States Constitution, have a right to get on the witness stand and tell their side of the story, whether the attorney wants them to or not, or whether the attorney thinks it's a good idea. And they classified, and later courts have classified that right as a fundamental right. So similarly, a trial counsel cannot get up and say, well, he doesn't want a jury's not a good idea, or he wants to accept this plea agreement and plead guilty.
Nobody doubts that at all. But why isn't testimony of this defendant offered by his counsel and made the basis of the trial itself? Why doesn't that satisfy it? Could it only be done if during the actual trial proceedings the defendant takes the stand?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the procedures where the counsel offers the statements of the defendant in evidence, received as evidence, is an invalid procedure, a common procedure.
It's invalid in this case because this...
Well, it would be invalid in all cases then, wouldn't it?
In this circumstance, because it is an entirely different evidentiary standard. Mr. Armstrong did not have the right to fully offer his defense to the charge because the Commonwealth most assuredly would have objected on relevance grounds, and the trial court would have properly sustained that objection, because there is a limited focus of the motion to suppress, which by statute could have been done.
When you offer something from a previous hearing in this proceeding, isn't that evidence, that transcript, then taken with the new standard of review applied to it? Why is it still held that since this was testified, and at that time what the judge was doing was applying a probable cause or some lower standard, why, when it's offered by the defense as evidence, why isn't it then subjected to the higher standard of review?
Because pursuant to Rock versus Arkansas, there can be limits placed on testimony. It's not the standard used at the motion to suppress the preponderance of the evidence. That's not what I'm resting on. It's the fact that Mr. Armstrong's testimony was limited to a degree that he could not offer his defense. And what Rock versus Arkansas and its progeny say is limits can be placed on a criminal accused's testimony at trial, but they can't be overly restrictive limits. And here, an overly restrictive limit was placed on Mr. Armstrong's testimony that did not allow him to offer a defense that he had a number of medical conditions and that the marijuana found was for personal use and not for distribution to other people. He would not have been allowed to offer that at the motion to suppress hearing because it was irrelevant. It was in no way connected to the argument his trial counsel was making about the reason for the stop. And that's an unconstitutional limitation on Mr. Armstrong's right to testify and offer his side of the story. And Rock versus Arkansas was clear in that holding, and subsequent cases have been clear in that holding as well. And we did provide the trial court with adequate notice in the motion to vacate as to provide it the opportunity to correct this error. And the trial court, in its rationale for its reasoning, said that it preemptively would not have believed Mr. Armstrong's testimony. That was the trial court's holding as to why it would not allow Mr. Armstrong to testify.
He said something about he was saving your client from perjuring himself, I think was the comment, right?
Well, that goes into the Commonwealth's second point about whether this should be properly brought up on a habeas. It should not be properly brought up on a habeas because the trial court's point was that perhaps trial counsel was being very effective in preventing Mr. Armstrong from doing that. My point is Mr. Armstrong had a right to testify. Whether it was a good idea or a bad idea, he had a right to get up there.
Did he wait too long, though? I mean, this is raised really late in the game.
But it was raised while the trial court had an opportunity to correct the issue. And I submit to the court that that's what this court demands. The trial court must be presented with the issue and given an opportunity to correct it. Mr. Armstrong, as was pointed out in the record, is of limited education, did not know he could speak up, and in fact was admonished by the trial court at the end of the trial, told to consult with his attorney and not to speak out of turn. So I submit that he did properly raise the issue in time for the trial court to fix it. And I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Goff. Mr. Obenshain, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chris Obenshain representing the Commonwealth in this matter. The appellant's argument here suffers from really three fundamental flaws, any one of which I think is sufficient to deny him relief on his claim before this court, really just take them kind of in reverse order of what I've presented them in the Commonwealth's brief. But first and foremost, the argument that a on-the-record waiver was required and denying him an on-the-record waiver was a denial of his constitutional rights, that argument was never presented to the trial court. The appellant's counsel asked for an on-the-record waiver, but when it was brought up in argument, suggested that it was within the court's discretion, not that the denial of an on-the-record waiver would be a denial of Mr. Armstrong's constitutional rights. Furthermore, there is absolutely no requirement in Virginia courts for an on-the-record waiver of an individual's right to testify. The United States Supreme Court has never clearly stated that this is a fundamental constitutional right. It has suggested it in a number of cases, including Rock, and we don't disagree that the defendant has a right to testify. But Rock also says that right is not absolute. And the dissent in Rock also points out that these type of rights occasionally also must yield to countervailing considerations. And in this particular instance, there's a very important countervailing consideration, which is the right to remain silent. So those are two sort of countervailing rights that the court has a responsibility to balance. And as we pointed out in our brief, there's a number of jurisdictions which have indicated that it would be inappropriate for the court to insert itself in the discussions between counsel and client as to whether he should testify. So on that basis, you know, the Commonwealth's first argument is that this particular argument, the constitutional application of the on-the-record waiver, that was not preserved before the trial court, and so he is not entitled to relief. Secondly, as was pointed out, really the claim that he's raising here is a thinly veiled claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. He's not pointed to any the error really is the fact that he wanted to say something more to the court and his attorney did not call him to the stand. And that is not an error of the trial court. That's not an error on the part of the Commonwealth. It's an error, if any error exists, which we do not concede that it necessarily does, but if it exists, that would be an error on the part of his counsel at trial. And the Virginia Supreme Court has clearly indicated that there is no relief on appeal for claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. Now, the third issue is really the crux of the case, I think, here. And the Commonwealth's position is that Mr. Armstrong's argument rests upon a false premise, which is that he did not get to testify at trial, when in fact he did get to testify at trial. The fact that there's a different standard at a motion to suppress versus a trial does not mean that there necessarily has to be different evidence. You can introduce the same evidence in a motion to suppress and at a trial and apply a different standard to that evidence and reach different, the trial court can reach different conclusions. And that's precisely what happened here. It in fact, happens all the time. Counsel really assumes facts that were not in evidence when saying that if his client had attempted to testify in a certain way, there would have been an objection and it would have been sustained. That's not what happened at the trial court. In fact, the record demonstrates that the trial court indicated to counsel that he would listen to whatever evidence they wanted to present and would not require them to put the same individuals on the stand twice in order to decide the motion to suppress and then decide the matter at trial. There was a discussion in the record about that. And the trial court basically said, you know, I can be here all day, but I don't have to be. And so there was that discussion of what the evidence would be. And furthermore, Mr. Armstrong did actually testify. If you look at the record, what he testified to went beyond the scope of the motion to suppress. The motion to suppress was based on whether there was consent to search his car. But he testified really to about everything that happened that day. He could have just been put on the stand by his counsel to testify, did you give the officers consent to search the car? No, I did not. There's your argument at the motion to suppress. But his testimony went beyond that. And when we get to the trial portion of the argument, Armstrong did, in fact, present a defense. His defense was, this wasn't my car. I didn't know the drugs were in the car. That was the defense. The testimony about his medical conditions, about what effect that may have had, he, in the record, Armstrong, alludes to it to the court, and then his counsel gets up and says, that's not relevant to the defense in this case. The implication is that this is mitigation evidence that they may present at sentencing, but it's not relevant to whether or not he was guilty of the underlying offense. So clearly, based upon the record, based upon the evidence, Armstrong did have an opportunity to get up, to present his side of the story, to present his evidence, and counsel argued from that in his defense. And both parties agreed to incorporate that evidence into the trial. So there was an agreement to that. The evidence was not necessarily limited just to the motion to suppress. And he had an opportunity to present his defense. The trial court did not preemptively decide that it wasn't going to believe his testimony. What the trial court was pointing out was that what he's testifying to today at the motion to vacate is different from what he testified to in the motion to suppress, which was then incorporated into the trial. And that could have subjected him to a potential perjury charge. And so because the right to testify is not unlimited, his counsel was, may have been exercising his due discretion in limiting his client's testimony so as not to expose his client to further charges. But that was not a denial of due process. That was not a denial of his right to testify. And in fact, the court at the end of the trial asked Mr. Armstrong if there was anything else he wanted to say. He tried to raise something. He made a comment about what the judge did for me the last time. But there was nothing raised about him wanting to testify. Furthermore, when he wrote this ex parte letter to the court, he never raised the issue of wanting to testify again. So the fact that Mr. Armstrong later on has, sort of buyer's remorse about the results of his trial does not give him the right to take that back and then get relief in terms of a new trial. He did have an opportunity to testify. That testify was considered by the court. And for all of those reasons, we would ask that you affirm the trial court.
Thank you, Mr. Obenshain. Mr. Goff, you have your rebuttal time.
The point the Commonwealth made about the on-the-record waiver The assignment of error is that the trial court erred in denying the motion to vacate for the reasons stated in the motion to vacate. Listing the various cases from different states about the on-the-record waiver was simply pointing out the standards that other cases use in cases such as this. And in fact, many Virginia courts, and I submit the Newport News Circuit Court now, does in fact ask about whether the right to testify has been discussed between a defendant and trial counsel on the record in a colloquy prior to a not guilty plea. So that was not the error assigned to the trial court. It was simply suggesting a possible remedy that other states have used in this case. But a trial court has an affirmative duty when there is a fundamental right involved, which I submit is the case here. I don't have to show, Mr. Armstrong does not have to show some affirmative denial of his right to testify. A fundamental right, such as the right to plead guilty or not guilty, or have a jury trial, not have a jury trial, have to be safeguarded by the trial court. And that was the point that Mr. Armstrong was trying to make, that no, of course the trial court did not say, Mr. Armstrong, you can't testify at trial. That was not the error assigned here. The error assigned here is that the trial court had a duty to ensure that Mr. Armstrong's fundamental rights were protected. Just as if trial counsel had gone in and said, Mr. Armstrong wishes to plead guilty and accept the plea bargain, that would not have been allowed. The trial court would have had to have heard that directly from Mr. Armstrong. And the same standard applies to the right to testify or right not to testify at trial. The only difference is,
if we take your argument, though, Mr. Goff, to its logical conclusion, couldn't you have a lot of games playing here where, you know, you're getting ready to pronounce not only guilt, but even the sentence later on. It's still in the bosom of the trial court, or even after the sentence, 21 days still in the bosom of the trial court. Your Honor, I wanted to testify. Where do you draw the line?
I draw the line, and that's where the on-the-record waiver came in. I draw the line there, Your Honor, that this could all be solved if this court would make clear that the question simply needs to be asked, usually at the beginning of trial, is how many circuit courts in Virginia already do it. If this court refers to the criminal bench book put out by a number of highly esteemed judges, that's one of the suggested questions in the bench book, is simply asking, has the issue been discussed, and are counsel and a criminal defendant in agreement about the issue? And if there's a suggestion they're not in agreement about the issue, then certainly the trial court can delve further. But that draws
people to change their minds as the trial goes on, too. You know, well, I didn't want to testify, but now I do, or vice versa. So.
And certainly it would be, at that point, there would be an affirmative duty on the part of the criminal defendant to make that known. But the court asks where the line should be drawn. I submit that's where the line should be drawn. That's where other states have drawn the line.
So add that to the colloquy, essentially.
How would that satisfy it? Wouldn't you have to get this affirmative waiver at the end of the trial? But how can you say he's waived his right to counsel if you ask him a question before the trial? Have you discussed whether you want to testify? In this case, it comes at the end of the trial, even after he's presented affirmative evidence.
Well, that's because the question was never asked to Mr. Armstrong during the colloquy, the same colloquy.
But how can the defendant be said to have waived his right to testify if you don't ask him before you close the trial proceedings?
The trial court has a duty to put the defendant on notice he has the right. That's all I'm saying.
Well, it seems to me what you're asking for is on-the-record waiver.
Yes, sir.
So you do say that's what you want.
That's what I think would be an appropriate.
Do you have any Virginia law that says that's been required?
I have a growing number of other states that have said that's the law.
I say you don't have any Virginia law.
I don't think there's any Virginia law to the contrary, Your Honor. If there are no further questions.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Goff. We will recounsel, and then the next case on our